Okay, good morning, everybody. This is 241, Bio 241. And let's see, what is the date? Today is the 5th of March. All right, so we got to come together. We got to start talking about respiration. So, and I don't want anybody to disturb other students that are around them. Okay, so if you got to carry on a conversation, go ahead, step outside. I don't mean to like strangle good conversation in here, but please be considerate of the people around you, especially if you're listening to music. Sometimes music comes through your earbuds and disturbs people, and you shouldn't even be listening to music in here, even if my speaking to you puts you in a very musical mode. I'm not sure. All right, so please be really considerate of people around you. And I just heard of something on TV this morning. Somebody was taking an airline flight, and there was somebody watching an adult movie on their little screen they were sitting next to. Okay, but they kind of were positioned to where they couldn't really see what was going on, but then whoever was watching that movie moved and unplugged the headset, okay? And, yeah, it was just very disturbing to everybody else on the airplane. So make sure, just don't listen, to, watch videos in here or listen to music, okay? Because you might...
Except for those in the Mile High Club,
right? Yeah, I guess something was going on, I'm not sure. Okay. All right, so... just go ahead and listen to lecture. If you want to type on your computer, that's fine. But again, you have to type kind of quietly. You have to type kind of quietly so that you don't disturb people around you, right? I know I used to work with a guy that just used to pound on the keyboard. He would disrupt the whole meeting. Okay, you're not pounding on your keyboard. That's good. All right, so all the recordings are online. And then I just remembered something, which is a really good study technique. And that is, after lecture, some people like to rewrite their notes just to review what was covered in lecture. And what I forgot was that learning process is dependent on how long after you write your notes compared to when you listen to the lecture. If you do it right after lecture, that is the best. If you wait a couple weeks and rewrite your notes after a couple weeks, that's not nearly as good, because by that time you forgot a lot of points maybe an instructor was making. So if you're going to rewrite notes, do it as soon as possible after the lecture. And that also goes for one other thing, and that is if you're going to listen to the lecture again online, and some of you I know like to listen to the lectures again online, it's best soon after the lecture, not 2 or 3 weeks down the line. All right, so because I don't have a video, it's just that audio file. So get to it as soon as you can. And as a result, I've been trying to get the lectures online within 2 days before the next lecture, all right? And you can always give me an email and remind me if I don't have it up there. All right, today's lecture I probably won't get online right away because, like I said, I got to give a test tonight. Here's your sign-in sheet. Go ahead, sign in, please. And here's that schedule once again on the 5th. That's today. Cell respiration, we may or may not finish that up. And then we're going to get into a really big chapter, nervous system. Neurons, synapses. Got 3 lectures scheduled for that. And then we're going to get into autonomic nervous system. You're a little bit familiar with autonomic nervous system. How many main divisions are there for autonomic nervous system? Yeah, there are 2. What's the relationship between them? Yeah, they're antagonistic. All right, so that's going to be the last bit of material for the next exam, which is on the 24th. And so how many weeks away is that? 1, 2 and a half. 2 and a half weeks away. All right, so I think probably everybody kind of has a sense on how to study for the class, exam figures, right? The study guide is important, and those online questions, practice questions for the online quiz every week, which then reminds me, what else is happening today? You get to earn some extra course points by doing what? The online quiz every Thursday night. So maybe you're already done with that weeks ago. So hopefully that is true. Okay. Well, I had a lot of questions this week. Yeah, here's another question.
Are you going to post the one to the same week as the exam for the thing? I think there's one that's not there.
Okay. You'll have to tell me what week that is. I'm not sure. Yeah. Yeah, maybe right after class if you don't go into lab, we can look at it. I'm not quite tracking what you're thinking of. But I'll try to make sure that all the materials that you need for exam number two are available in Blackboard, okay, for you to look at. Okay. Well, before I turn the lights down, I notice that I have a couple, what are these things? Yeah, chemical reactions right here. And it has to do with energetics. And some people have had a lot of questions about this. And I see a couple substrates here, A and B. These are physical chemicals, right? But there's something else you think you should have, you should think of as a physical identity of something, and that is energy, right? And so if we put A and B along with some energy together, we get these two products, C and D. Now, what can you tell me about this reaction right here? There's a way that we would classify this reaction. For instance, is it oxidation-reduction reaction? No, I wouldn't want to think of it that way. But how would I want to think about this top one right here? Okay? Because it requires energy, this is an endergonic reaction. It's really good that, right, you see that really clearly. Okay? This means, because of the way that I wrote it, C and D have more energy, right, compared to A plus B. Right? C and D has more energy than A plus B, so energy has to go in. That is an endergonic reaction. All right, what about the same reaction, but now let's think about it going the other way. Let's have C plus D changing into A plus B and energy. What kind of reaction is that? That's an exergonic. You know what? I better write this on the board. Can I get to the board without the microphone going funny? Yeah. All right, so here it is. Exergonic. Here is endergonic. And you could probably relate this to probably one of your favorite chemical reactions in terms of ATP. If you're making ATP, which one of these two is it going to be if you're making ATP?
Endergonic.
Okay, it's going to be endergonic because over here would be what? ADP plus inorganic phosphate plus energy. All right, is going to go to make ATP. All right, and so that energy is an ATP. And that's why your body uses ATP as an energy source, because when you go in the reverse direction, all right, so if you have ATP right here, what do you get? ADP plus inorganic phosphate plus energy. All right, so energy. All right, so the hydrolysis of ATP into ADP, inorganic phosphate, releases energy, and we call that, okay? Yeah, that's hydrolysis, but that is what? The exergonic reaction. Can you use quotes when you go up? I'm not sure. Maybe if you'd go like this. I don't know. Okay, I'm not really sure. Okay, so treat that energy as a real physical entity. Right, for you to understand whether something is endergonic or exergonic. Put that in the equation. All right, so what else do we know? ADP plus PI to make ATP requires energy, right? That's endergonic. So what kind of reaction has to be coupled in order to make ATP? An exergonic reaction. And we looked at a whole metabolic pathway last time that is exergonic. And what was that metabolic pathway? That was exergonic. Da-da-da-da. You saw it. Saw it right here. This is glycolysis, right? Nice. Okay, the only funny thing about glycolysis is that it does have an activation energy barrier, and two ATPs have to be expended before glycolysis can run all the way through. All right, so going from this metabolite down here to pyruvic acid, and you can see the energy levels change. So that releases energy, that release of energy can, right, drive the synthesis of ATP. And when ATP is made in this way, we call this substrate level phosphorylation. Right, so what's being phosphorylated? Adenosine diphosphate is being phosphorylated. It's being converted into ATP. So this is what we call substrate level phosphorylation. We're going to find another kind, and once we compare the two, it will make a lot more sense. But just write down substrate level phosphorylation. All right, so where were we last time? We were right about here. We got done talking about glycogenesis, glycogenolysis. Have you reviewed those terms a little bit in your mind? Glycolysis, gluconeogenesis, those four terms, right? And that's going to take us to the Cori cycle, unless you all have some questions about what we talked about last time. Anybody have any questions? Maybe I should give you the quiz right now. Let's go take that quiz, which has to do with this first figure, right, which I said is really important. You should think of this figure anytime we're talking about anything in this particular chapter. All right, so my question was, is the purpose of all this metabolism to get rid of glucose? You see, glucose is being gotten rid of. Is it to produce CO2? Is it to produce water? Because water is a very important thing in our body. Is that, that's not it. What else? Is it to produce lactic acid? No. So what's the whole purpose of all this, this big diagram right here? Is to make ATP. Right, so that's not even on this diagram, but you should probably write that in someplace. And we've talked about glycolysis. How many ATP are produced by glycolysis? Two. Yeah, so you might just want to write down two. Four are produced, but two are used up in order to get glycolysis going, so put a net two just in this process. All right, so all of this, I tell you what, this right here, glucose to pyruvic acid, it can operate under anaerobic conditions or aerobic conditions, either way. So pyruvic acid has two fates, depending on whether the environment is high in oxygen or low in oxygen. If it's low, then anaerobic respiration takes over, right? And that's, pyruvate is converted into lactic acid. However, if oxygen is present, that pyruvic acid can enter the mitochondria, right? And we're going to look at that a little bit later today. All right, and then we're going to fill in how much ATP is produced by some of these other parts of this diagram. And so operating, what about pyruvic acid to lactic acid? Is any ATP produced when that happens? No ATP is produced. So when glucose goes all the way to lactic acid, how many ATP are produced? Two by glycolysis, and that's it. Right, two by glycolysis. So how many ATPs are produced by anaerobic respiration for every glucose? Yeah, there's only two. Right? Yeah, so do you see that pathway all the way through here? Only two, because that's what you get from glycolysis. Fortunately, there are some other very important reactions right here where we can get a lot more ATP for every glucose molecule. And eventually we're going to get into that, but we got to finish up Cori cycle first. All right, so some of these pathways in the Cori cycle are not listed in your textbook, so you got to take some pretty good notes, talk to some friends about it. So here we have two types of cells. We have skeletal muscle and we have liver. And under exercise, right, because that's what skeletal muscles like to do, well, under exercise there's a special kind of interaction with the liver that is taking place. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let's go one and one. Oh, and let me go to the slideshow mode, too. That will help. Sorry, I'm thinking about too much at one time. Pointer options, arrow options, visible. Okay, good. Thanks for reminding me. Okay, so here's the Cori cycle. The two kinds of tissues we have are skeletal muscle and liver. Right, and they're not connected to each other, but in a sense they're connected to each other via the blood, right? So they can share metabolites sometimes. All right, so here we have glucose-6-phosphate. And first thing, think about glucose-6-phosphate. Can it get out of this skeletal muscle cell?
No.
No, and why is that? Because that phosphate group is highly polar. Polar compounds can't go through the cell membrane, right? So this phosphate is indeed trapped inside the cell. Well, under resting conditions where the cell has high ATP, that glucose-6-phosphate is going to be stored, or that glucose is going to be stored. And it's going to be stored in the form of glycogen, right? For osmotic reasons, right? That's a really powerful consideration. I'm not going to describe that right now, but if you're not familiar with that terminology or why I'm thinking that way, then you got to see me or your lab instructor, right? Okay, so what is number 9? Glucose-6-phosphate-2-glycogen. What is this called right here, number 9? Okay, it says rest, and indeed, at rest, when this when the cell has a lot of energy because it's not contracting, but this arrow right here, what would we want to call this arrow, which I'm calling number 9? Okay, it's storing glucose, right? It's converting glucose to glycogen. What do we call that kind of, that process? Okay. Okay, it's not gluconeogenesis, it's glycogenesis, right? Because it's making glycogen, glycogenesis. All right, when this muscle starts to exercise, it uses up ATP, wants to generate some ATP, and it can do so if it has glucose, so it's going to break its glycogen store down into glucose. What do we call arrow number 1 over here during exercise? That is? Okay. This is glycogen being broken down, so it's glycogenolysis. Yeah, glycogen lysis, right? But we put a little O between them because that's what we like to do. Okay, glycogenolysis. All right, so we have glucose, and the cell wants to get some ATP out of this glucose. And one step that can be used is that this glucose can be snipped apart into 2 pyruvic acid molecules. What is that called? The lysis of glucose is glycolysis, right? Glycolysis. All right, so this is what's happening during heavy exercise. And during heavy exercise in skeletal muscles, they don't have a lot of oxygen. So in order to keep glycolysis operating, what happens to pyruvic acid? It gets converted into lactic acid. No ATP is produced by the conversion for pyruvate to lactic acid. But so what's the purpose of this LDH pathway? It regenerates NAD+, right? Because NAD+ is necessary to have glycolysis working. And if you want to write down the number of ATPs here, you can. Glycolysis produces 2. Yeah, 2 ATPs. Ah, okay. Pyruvic acid to lactic acid. The purpose of this pathway is twofold. And the first thing is that it regenerates NAD+. Right, because glycolysis, glucose to pyruvic acid, when that happens, NAD plus is converted into NADH. And NADH has to be dealt with, otherwise it's going to close down glycolysis and you won't even be able to make those 2 ATP. Okay? So it regenerates NAD plus from NADH. Plus, if lactic acid builds up inside the cell, that will also inhibit glycolysis because of Le Chatelier's principle or that law of mass action. So this pyruvic acid can't build up inside the cell and have glycolysis maintained at a rate that will serve this cell. So pyruvic acid, under anaerobic conditions, is gotten rid of by being converted to lactic acid, and this lactic acid can leave the skeletal muscle cell. And that decreases the concentration of pyruvate inside the cell, so that what? Glycolysis can still keep going. And then the other thing we said was it regenerates NAD. It's a necessary substrate for glycolysis. All right, so lactic acid, how many carbons are in lactic acid? Okay, how many carbons are in pyruvic acid? There's 3, and it's the same thing. This is in lactic acid, there are 3. There's no decarboxylation or anything funny happening. It's just an oxidation reduction reaction. All right, and so now you have lactic acid in the blood, and here we have a liver cell. So lactic acid then can diffuse into this liver cell and picks this lactic acid up, and that reverse LDH reaction can take place, right? And that's lactic acid is converted into pyruvic acid. And what do we, so number 5, what would you label number 5? That would just be like the LDH reaction, for instance, that would be fine. Lactate dehydrogenase reaction. It's just running in the opposite way, and that's okay. That's a reaction that can go forwards or backwards based on the concentration of substrates and products. Right? And then here we got pyruvic acid going to glucose. So again, how many carbons in pyruvic acid? 3. How many in glucose? 6. How many pyruvic acids do you need to make a glucose? You only need two. Put two pyruvic acids together, you get glucose. So what do we call number six, this arrow right here? That's another one of those words that you need your reading glasses for. Right? It is?
Gluconeogenesis.
Yeah, gluconeogenesis. All right, so here's this liver cell that has glucose-6-phosphate. And if this liver cell has high energy stores, right, then it's going to take that glucose-6-phosphate and add it to a glycogen. It's going to polymerize this glucose into glycogen. So what is this process over here once again? It's the same as over here, number 9. Glycogenesis, right? Under energy demands of the body, that glycogen in the liver can be broken down with this down arrow, and that down arrow you're going to call glycogenolysis, right? The lysis of glycogen, and that's going to produce glucose-6-phosphate. But, like I said over here for this muscle cell, can this glucose-6-phosphate leave this liver cell? Can this glucose-6-phosphate? Almost a little bit of a tricky question. The exact answer is no, right? But there is something that can happen in the liver that will allow the liver to secrete glucose. Yeah, this phosphate can be taken off, and we said that an enzyme that takes phosphate off of something is called a phosphatase, and with modern nomenclature, we just use the substrate, which is what, glucose-6-phosphate, and then since it's a phosphatase, glucose-6-phosphatase is the exact name of this enzyme right here, number 7. All right, so you just draw that in. So that gives you glucose. Glucose can leave the cell into the blood, goes back to this skeletal muscle cell, and then the skeletal muscle cell takes this glucose, phosphorylates it with what kind of enzyme? A kinase, like a glucose kinase. And so now this glucose is trapped inside the cell, all right, can never leave. But since this glucose that it got from the liver is inside the cell, what can this muscle cell do? Use it for energy. Yeah, and so this glucose goes all the way down to lactic acid, how many ATP are produced? Okay. Yeah, there's two that are produced, right? So this is one way of shifting the metabolic demand of the skeletal muscle to the liver. So the liver will help give some energy to these skeletal muscle cells because for gluconeogenesis to take place, that requires some ATP. So ATP is put back into this system, right, with step number 6, and that energy is transferred to the muscle cell, and with glycolysis, right, that muscle cell still can get some ATP. Even though it's operating under what kind of conditions? Under what kind of conditions? Anaerobic. Yeah, under anaerobic conditions.
Anaerobic, low oxygen.
Low oxygen, that's right, because it's exercising. All right, so how many fates? Let's just review. I haven't talked about this in a couple minutes. How many fates does pyruvic acid have?
Two.
What are its possible fates? Anaerobic respiration, right, via the LDH, or aerobic respiration. Ah, wow, somebody just mentioned that, aerobic respiration. Okay, before we start looking at some more of these slides, anybody have some questions about that? So if you're exercising your muscles strenuously, what other organ are you exercising strenuously? The liver, yeah, the liver is participating with that muscle activity, yeah. It will be blunted, okay, when you're in a fed state, and it will be accelerated when you're in a fasted state for a long while. Even if you're in a fasted state, your liver can run out of glycogen. Say after you run about 22 miles, then your liver is going to run out of glycogen, but the liver is still going to be getting lactic acid from that muscle. Right, and so gluconeogenesis will still be taking place as long as this liver cell has oxygen available to make ATP. Yeah, yeah.
Eight,
right here. Ah, that's just, you know, you could put glucose kinase right here. Glucose kinase really is inside the skeletal muscle cell. I think what number 8 is just transport of glucose in the blood. Your book really doesn't mention it. If anybody sees what number 8 is, how it's defined in your book, I'd like to know. But I don't think
it has numbers, just like it's
It doesn't define what the numbers are. Usually when you have a figure like this with numbers that aren't described in the text, it's at least given to you in the text underneath the figure. Okay, but it's not. It got lost somehow. So it's good that we're talking about it, because this is an important process. All right, so aerobic respiration. Let's go back. Sorry about switching so fast. Where does aerobic respiration take place once again? Yeah, mitochondria. And there are three important processes in the mitochondria, okay, that's going to harvest more ATP. So let's make sure we know right on the tip of our tongue what these three processes are, these three pathways. Well, I see Krebs, that's one. Okay, I see electron transport, that's another. And there's one that's kind of hidden, but somebody told me last time that they knew the preparatory reaction. Yeah, and the preparatory reaction takes place first. And so let's talk about that first. Let's see what's going on with this preparatory reaction. All right, so what molecule enters the mitochondria? Okay, the molecule that enters the mitochondria is pyruvic acid. Okay, pyruvic acid is leaving the cytosol. And that's a good thing because now glycolysis won't be inhibited, right, because it's leaving. So here's pyruvic acid. It's going to combine with a compound that has this sulfhydryl group on it. And this pyruvic acid, right, is going to be decarboxylated in this particular reaction. But also, it's going to be oxidized. No, it's going to be reduced. I'm sorry, it's going to be reduced in the process. And if it's going to be reduced, something else has to be oxidized. Okay. All right, so that's where NAD plus comes into play. All right, NAD, what can you tell me about NAD? Small metal ion or large organic compound? Large. So NAD is a coenzyme. That's right, it's a coenzyme. And remember, definition of a coenzyme is that it transfers or carries something from one set of reactions to another. And what it's carrying are these high energy electrons. Right? So when it receives high energy electrons, it becomes reduced. NADH is the reduced form. And now where is this NADH that I'm looking at right here? Is this in the cytosol or in the mitochondria? Mitochondria. That will be significant in just a little bit. Okay. So these high energy electrons are now inside the mitochondria. And after that decarboxylation, this two carbon fragment gets joined to coenzyme A. All right, so now we have that two carbon fragment, which the two carbons come from pyruvic acid, bound to coenzyme A. Then this coenzyme A with this two carbon fragment is called acetyl coenzyme A, carries it to another set of chemical reactions, right? Namely the Krebs cycle. And what do we call something that carries some moiety to another set of chemical reactions? A coenzyme, and that's how it got named, right? Maybe this is the first coenzyme that somebody discovered, coenzyme A, like number one. Okay, so don't forget about this decarboxylation reaction. Happens in the preparatory reaction. It's not labeled on this slide, but I like that terminology and way of thinking about this reaction right here. Right, because it's so important, it produces CO2. Where did this gas molecule come from? Where did this carbon come from? Pyruvic acid, which came from glucose. Yeah, okay, so that's interesting. All right, so NAD plus is oxidized, NADH is reduced. Okay, and so now we have acetyl coenzyme A inside the mitochondria. And it's going to deliver how many carbon fragment to the Krebs cycle? Pyruvate has three, but it's been decarboxylated in the preparatory reaction, so it's going to deliver two to the Krebs cycle. And so here is acetyl group. Whenever you hear of acetate or acetyl, you're automatically going to think of two. I think that's an important number to remember. All right. So, and then where is the Krebs cycle located? Inside the mitochondria. It operates under aerobic conditions. So this decarboxylation step in the preparatory reaction only happens under aerobic conditions. Right? And in the preparatory reaction, are any ATP made directly? No, only NADH. Right? And there's energy in NADH in the form of those high energy electrons. All right, so Acetyl-CoA donates this two-carbon group to oxaloacetic acid, and that's a four-carbon molecule. When that four-carbon is joined with another two-carbon, that makes a six-carbon molecule called citric acid. And through the process of this cycle, oxaloacetic acid is regenerated, and which is a C4 group, and this cycle can go over and over and over again, so we call this the Krebs cycle. Another way that we can talk about this is the citric acid cycle. Sometimes people talk about this cycle, but I'm only going to talk about it in terms of Krebs cycle. It's also called the tricarboxylic acid cycle because there are three carboxyl groups if you look carefully at some of these compounds. All right, so for every turn of Krebs cycle, all right, we see a couple decarboxylations. We see a couple carbon dioxides being released. So the question, a really good question to answer is, where does all the CO2 that we're breathing out of our body, where does it come from? What organelle is producing all of that CO2? Mitochondria, preparatory reaction one, the remaining two through Krebs cycle. Okay. Well, let's look in a little bit more detail. I'm not going to ask you to know any of these intermediates, but I do want you to know what the overall yield of this reaction is. So let's take a little bit closer look at it, okay? All right, so here we have acetyl-CoA transferring that acetyl group to oxaloacetic acid, and that's neither oxidation reduction, it doesn't produce an ATP, it just produces citric acid. Right. And then there's some rearrangements, and then finally, here we have a decarboxylation of one of these carboxyl groups. All right, so when we take that carboxyl group off, what are we left with? Five carbons plus a CO2. Right. And when that happens, there is some energy that's released. That energy can be stored in the form of high-energy electrons. So for every turn of the cycle, one NAD plus is converted into an NADH at this particular step when this decarboxylation reaction happens. All right, so there's another step right here. From this metabolite over here to succinic acid, there is another oxidation reduction reaction that takes place, right, with another decarboxylation reaction. So here is carbon dioxide being released. So now that's all three of the carbons that entered the mitochondria, one through the preparatory reaction, two from the Krebs cycle, right, and that step generates an NADH. And there's something else that happens here. Look at this. We have a GDP. It can be phosphorylated into GTP. GTP is very similar to ATP, has the same energy level, and so GTP can be used to generate an ATP molecule from ADP. So strictly speaking, Krebs cycle makes a GTP, but I think for the purposes of this course, you should just think of ATP being produced in this step. So in this step, what is produced? NADH and 1-ATP. The production of ATP in this step is also called substrate level phosphorylation, the same kind of phosphorylation that we saw in glycolysis. And got to wait for just a little bit until you learn about the other kind of phosphorylation step that can make ATP. All right, then there's some more rearrangements, right? And so now you're back to four carbon molecules with some rearrangements. There can be another oxidation reduction reaction that produces another NADH, which has those high energy electrons. So NADH, this NADH, right, can donate these electrons to make more ATP. There's something I forgot, but I just saw right here. All right, so NAD is a coenzyme that accepts high-energy electrons, but I also see another coenzyme that can accept high-energy electrons in the Krebs cycle. And what is that? FADH, yep, can be converted into FADH2, and that is also carrying some high-energy electrons, similar, but not exactly the same as NADH. All right. So what is the yield of one turn of the Krebs cycle? 1, 2, 3 NADH. 1-FADH2, and all of those have high-energy electrons, and then the last thing is 1-ATP, right? And if you want to know, for every glucose molecule, what do you have to multiply those numbers by?
2.
Right, because the Krebs cycle turns twice for every glucose, right? It turns once for every pyruvic acid. All right, what else is important? You got to know where Krebs cycle is, what organelle it is, and under what kind of conditions. Mitochondria, and that basically just means aerobic conditions, right? Okay, what's the other kind of fun, noteworthy thing to know about the Krebs cycle? It's the reason why we exhale. It produces, yeah, two CO2s. Don't forget that preparatory reaction that's not on this slide also produces carbon dioxide as well. All right, so that's the Krebs cycle, producing some ATP for us. But again, that's not very impressive. We need a whole lot more ATP. And as a matter of fact, in terms of your body weight, how much ATP do you need every day? I think I mentioned this. Okay. Well, there's different references. I calculated it one time to be over half your body weight. Okay. Some sources say equal to your body weight, so somewhere in that ballpark. All right. And if you're going to only make one ATP with the Krebs cycle, that's not nearly enough to keep us alive. Okay. Because we need a lot more. All right. So we're going to do something with these high energy electrons. Well, in the process of making that one ATP by substrate level phosphorylation, those decarboxylation steps are necessary. The production of CO2 is necessary. Okay, so Krebs cycle makes ATP for us, one for every turn, but don't forget three NADHs and also one FADH2. Okay. And they're carrying these high energy electrons, so immediately you should start thinking about what? Oxidation reduction reactions. Right? Because FADH2 and ADH are the reduced form of those coenzymes. They're carrying those electrons. They received the electrons from someplace. Alright, so I wanted to change your thinking just a little bit. Alright, so here is that last step on this. I should actually put this in various places. Right, so here is that last reaction. Right, here's the preparatory reaction inside the mitochondria. Here's Krebs cycle. You might just want to write down what the Krebs cycle produces for every turn on this diagram. One ATP, three NADHs, one FADH2. How many carbon dioxides? Two, right? Then you know really a lot about the Krebs cycle. Now, the NADH, FADH2, will donate electrons to this last metabolic pathway right here, which we call electron transport. So there's going to be a series of oxidation reduction reactions taking place. So now let's talk about electron transport or the electron transport chain. Okay, here it is right here. All right, I sort of have a picture of a mitochondria, but not exactly. Can you, in your mind, you have a picture of a mitochondria? Get that picture out in your mind. And if you look inside of a mitochondria, what kind of structures do you see? Do you see like, yeah, you see all the folded membranes? Okay, and then on the outside of those folded membranes, you see? Yeah, you see another membrane, right? So there's an outer membrane that's not folded. You have an inner membrane, we call it Christi, and it has all of those folds. And so you have that intermembrane space, then you have the matrix inside the Christi membrane. All right, so you got all these different compartments. Here I see a number of chemicals, right, like FMN, right, coenzyme Q, cytochrome B, cytochrome C1, and C. All of these chemicals are embedded in the Christi membrane. So they're not in the outer membrane, they're in the inner membrane. And these compounds can accept the electrons and also pass them on to another neighboring molecule. But what we're looking at right here is a plot of free energy. Right? And as we go vertical, that means the free energy is increasing for each of one of these particular chemicals. All right, so what chemical has more free energy, coenzyme Q or cytochrome A3? I got to check to see if you can read the diagram. Which is more? Yeah, coenzyme Q, right, has more free energy compared to cytochrome A3. All right. What about, here's a good question, what about FADH2 or NADH? Which one has more free energy?
NADH.
Yeah, that shows you really nicely, right? So there, NADH is carrying more energy than FADH2. All right, so that's an important consideration, and you see it nicely shown on this slide. So remember, NADH is the reduced form. It can bump into FMN on the Christi membrane and It can reduce FMN into FMNH2. You don't have to remember all of these different steps. But what kind of reaction is this? This is an oxidation reduction reaction. And when these electrons are transferred, right, some of that energy in those high energy electrons can be used to do different things. And that's going to be on one of the upcoming slides. Okay, so going from this first step where NADH reduces FMN, going down here to coenzyme Q, one ATP can be produced, right? Because this is what? These electrons going from FMN to coenzyme Q is an exorganic reaction, right? And what can exorganic reactions do? Yeah, can drive endergonic reactions like reactions for making ATP. All right, so one ATP is produced here. Coenzyme Q, right, gets electrons from above, but it also gets a couple of electrons, or possibly from FADH2. And when these electrons are then shared or transferred over to cytochrome B and then B to C1 and C2, look, there's another step right here where ATP can be produced. Okay, and so that is an endergonic reaction driven by the exergonic reaction of electrons going from cytochrome B to C1. And these electrons then get transferred to some other compounds in what membrane again is that? The Christi membrane, yeah, on the inner membrane inside the mitochondria. Then here is a third step when electrons go from cytochrome A to A3. And again, is that exergonic or endergonic reaction? That is exorganic, and that can drive the endergonic reaction of making another ATP. So none of these compounds like cytochromes, right, B, A3, coenzyme Q, they don't change. They just become either oxidized or reduced, right, in pairs. And as these electrons travel through this chain of proteins and cytochromes in that Christi membrane, right, ATP is produced. So for every NADH, how many ATP are produced? Three. Right, and that's the number I want you to know. Yeah, question.
So all of the enzymes in there are in the inner membrane.
That's right.
Okay.
Yep, they're right inside the membrane. So here you have electrons traveling through all these compounds in that membrane, and as a matter of fact, you could almost think of all these compounds right here as like a wire, where electrons are just traveling right through, right? And how many ATP can be produced by one FADH2?
One.
I see two. One, two. NADH, three. FADH has less free energy, so it can only make two. That's a nice, another important point that you should know. Okay, so this is the theoretical maximum number of ATP that can be produced via the electron transport chain, right, or ETC, and that's just what I want you to know. Three for NADH, two for FADH2. Now, our cells are not operating exactly under ideal, optimal conditions all the time, so that might be a little bit less, just depending on circumstances. Your book likes to make give you the figure that NADH produces 2.5 ATP for every pair of electrons, right, and 1.5 for every FADH2. And so that's how they tally up ATP, but I'm really not so interested in that because the number is not 3, is not 2.5 for NADH. Sometimes it is 2.75. Sometimes it's 2.62, right? So it changes around all the time, and scientists will be talking about that number for maybe 1,000 years or so, and you got to take a test before that 1,000 years is up. All right, so what are we going to say in this class? How many ATP inside the mitochondria, when NADH is inside the mitochondria, how many ATP can be produced?
Three.
And for every FADH2, how many ATP can be produced? That's two. That's right. Okay, and remember, these things come from the Krebs cycle. Okay, they come from the Krebs cycle. Most of them do. All right, so what else is interesting? Well, these electrons will only flow from FMNH2, right, to coenzyme Q if coenzyme Q is oxidized, right? If coenzyme Q is reduced already, then it can't accept any more electrons, right? So if coenzyme Q is reduced, how does it get oxidized so that it can accept more electrons? it has to reduce something else, right? It's got to reduce cytochrome B. And then cytochrome B can't accept any more electrons unless it can get rid of those electrons that it got. So then cytochrome C1 becomes reduced all the way down over here to cytochrome A3, right? And cytochrome A3 can't accept any more electrons until it becomes oxidized one more time. All right, so where do those electrons go? So we have cytochrome A3 in a reduced form. The electrons are stuck right there. Electron transport chain is going to stop. So cytochrome A3 has to get rid of those electrons. How does it get rid of those electrons?
It gives it to
oxygen. That's right. So those electrons end up in oxygen, and it also takes some protons out of solution, and it makes what out of it? Oh, it's kind of hiding, very shy. Water, right? H2O. So what's the final product of the electron transport chain?
Water.
Yeah, that's the overall balanced reaction. You're exactly right. But the last thing that's produced is water. Right? That's kind of novel. Now, where does this oxygen come from that keeps the electron transport chain operating? Okay. Yeah, oxygen is just in the air we breathe. Right? So that's the reason why we inhale. If we can't inhale, that oxygen can't get into your body, can't get into the mitochondria, what happens to ETC then when you stop breathing? Yeah, it stops. It just stops at cold because the electrons can't flow anywhere through the ETC. Okay. All right, so this step, these steps right here that are producing ATP, we don't call that substrate level phosphorylation. We call this oxidative phosphorylation, right? Because oxygen is necessary to accept those electrons. So now you know two forms of phosphorylation. What are the two forms?
Substrate level
and oxidative phosphorylation. Nice. Where does oxidative phosphorylation take place? Okay, that's a little bit of a nebulous question. I heard a lot of good answers. Some people said Christi membrane. Yeah, that's true. What about the organelle? Mitochondria. Yeah, really nice. Okay, so you could say mitochondria, or you could say that Christi membrane. Hopefully somebody remembers that's inside of mitochondria. So oxidative phosphorylation takes place in mitochondria under what kind of conditions?
Aerobic
conditions. All right, what about substrate level phosphorylation? In this chain of events that we're looking at on this slide, do you see any substrate level phosphorylation? And the answer is no. Okay, I only see oxidative phosphorylation because it's the result of all of these oxidation reduction reactions. It's not due to any enzymatic change of anything. Okay, now,
we see a GTP.
Yeah, I see a GTP. Where was that at? Krebs cycle. So that shares something similar with electron transport. Okay, that GTP is not made by electron transport, but it shares something similar to it. What does it share that's similar? Because Krebs cycle is in mitochondria, just like ETC. And when do things happen inside the mitochondria? Only under what kind of conditions?
Aerobic
conditions, right? So don't be kind of tricked by that. It's kind of a subtle thought that the phosphorylation of GDP in Krebs cycle is still substrate level phosphorylation, even though it happens under aerobic conditions only. Okay. It's just as a result of an enzymatic reaction. Now, where is another place for substrate level phosphorylation? Glycolysis, yeah. And that happens under aerobic or anaerobic conditions, right? So oxidative phosphorylation absolutely happens under aerobic conditions. Substrate phosphorylation can happen under anaerobic or aerobic, but if it's anaerobic, it's only in glycolysis, right? Not through anything that happens in the Krebs cycle. All right, so that might be important. So how, this is kind of mysterious. A couple of people won some Nobel Prizes. How does this ATP get produced? I mean, we see a nice exergonic set of reactions right here, so there's energy available, but how does this phosphorylation actually take place? And that is the result of this slide right here. All right, so when I look at this top row, what does that remind you of that I'm circling with my cursor? Phospholipid bilayer, membrane, right? That just jumps out right at you. And then what about right underneath it? Another membrane. What organelle do you know has two membranes? Mitochondria, right? So here we're looking at a mitochondria here's the outer membrane, here's the Christi membrane. We said the Christi membrane has all of those cytochromes in it, and indeed, I see them embedded in the Christi membrane. You got the intermembrane space, and then you have the matrix, right, which is a space that's deep to the Christi membrane. Okay, so this is how it works. It's called the chemiosmotic theory. So here is a protein in the Christi membrane, and if there's NADH inside the matrix, right, that's deep inside the mitochondria, they can oxidize NADH. That means that this protein right here accepts electrons from it, right, and that regenerates NAD+. These electrons then are transferred to the next cytochrome in line, and when it does so, it releases some energy. That energy can be used as a pump, right? The movement of electrons through this part of the Christi membrane, right, acts as a pump, and it will take protons from the matrix and put it into the intermembrane space. And since it's a pump, what can you tell me about the concentration gradient? Yeah, it's going against the concentration gradient, which means that in the intermembrane space, is that full of protons or low in protons? It's full, right? It's a very acid compartment. It's full with protons, right? And so protons are pumped out of the matrix. Now, so what can you tell me about this space right here that's full of protons? Do all those protons want to go back into the matrix? Absolutely, down their concentration gradient. They'd love to get down there, but they can't get through this membrane, right, because it's a polar compound. Well, meanwhile, these electrons are still moving down ETC, goes through another proton pump, right, and another bunch of protons gets pumped into the intermembrane space, and then finally, here is a third protein that pumps another couple of protons into this membrane space, making what, this intermembrane space very acidic, high, very high concentration in protons. The matrix, very low in protons. Right. Protons are dying to get back across, they can't, except that here is a pathway where they can go back. Right, so here is what we call a respiratory assembly. It's a channel that allows protons to move down their concentration gradient. Right, and so when something goes from high to low, well, I tell you what, here's a good question. What is stored in a concentration gradient? A gradient of sodium, for instance, or a gradient of electrons. What's stored in a gradient? Energy, and energy is the ability to do work, right? So here's that big concentration gradient that gives this mitochondria the ability to do work. When these electrons flow through this respiratory assembly, then this little piece of the assembly right here can take an inorganic phosphate and ADP and make an ATP out of it. As these protons go through, you could think of this as like a water wheel or something, right? That energy is transferred. The motion of these protons is transferred into chemical energy that's stored in ATP. So what kind of reaction does this respiratory assembly undergo? Is it this one right here? Yeah, because what's the energy? What's the energy that we're looking at on this slide? The concentration gradient of protons, right? All right, so that's what we call the chemiosmotic theory. The enzyme that makes ATP inside the matrix is called an ATP synthase or an ATP synthetase. And so what's really pretty cool about this is that anywhere along the Christi membrane, as long as there's this respiratory assembly, it can work. It doesn't have to be in direct contact with anything in the electron transport chain. It just needs to have a gradient across this membrane. So it's an interesting way of transmitting power through this the walls of the mitochondria. Okay, what else do I want to say about that? Not so much, but just remember, energy is stored in the gradient, and that can be used, right, to do work, and the work that it's doing, right, is synthesizing ATP. Okay, so the transfer of these electrons through electron transport chain, is that exorganic or endorganic? Endorganic or exorganic? The movement of these electrons. Exorganic, that's right. And that energy, that exorganic energy is used to increase the gradient, the concentration gradient of protons across this inner mitochondrial membrane. All right, and then with this respiratory assembly, can be used to make ATP. This step right here is what we call oxidative phosphorylation because these electrons only move if oxygen is present to accept them. Right? So oxidative phosphorylation requires this really nifty scheme that we see inside mitochondria. And the other form, what is the other form of ATP synthesis? Substrate level phosphorylation. Okay. Sometimes it's called direct level. Substrate and direct are the same, but oxidation requires this really fancy kind of system, okay, which requires oxygen. Now, somebody had a question. Yes.
Why are we calling for the oxidase? Because we don't see any oxidase and
how can we know that? Well, you know that electrons are being transferred from one molecule to another. Do you see these electrons hopping over from here to here to here? So when electrons move from one molecule to another, that is a reduction reaction, but they're always coupled with a oxidation reaction, right? So when this ubiquinone becomes reduced, what happens to this first pump? It becomes oxidized. Okay, so electrons are just jumping from one molecule to another right here. They're releasing their energy, and that's exergonic, right? And that produces this proton gradient, which then can be used to make ATP with this respiratory assembly. Yeah.
So you're saying that after the first pump, it becomes oxidized, right?
Okay. Here's the first pump. It receives electrons from NADH. NADH becomes oxidized, yeah, NAD+. And then this first pump right here becomes reduced. Okay. And then as this electron jumps over to the next molecule, this next molecule becomes reduced. The first pump becomes oxidized. And when it becomes oxidized, what can NADH do then? Yeah, it can donate some more electrons, right? But if ubiquinone is in a reduced state, it can't accept electrons from this first pump. These electrons can't flow, right? So protons aren't going to be pumped, ATP can't be produced. That's why electrons have to flow from one molecule to another down ETC, right, in order for these protons to be pumped up into the intermembrane space, which then will drive this ATP synthase. All right, so what's the final acceptor of all these electrons? Because they got to be moving through here, you see it, oxygen, right, along with some protons, that produces water. Yeah, so I think maybe you had that question. You know, I see oxygen here. I do see oxygen. Yeah, so this is oxidative phosphorylation. Okay. I like for you to think of this as the transfer of electrons. And that's because we call this the electron transport chain, not the proton transfer chain. You could think of it that way, but I think of it maybe a little bit more archaic sense. I think of it in terms of electrons, okay? Okay. Okay, so here is something interesting. So under aerobic conditions, what do mitochondria give us? Under aerobic conditions? Yeah, aerobic conditions, mitochondria give us ATP. Yeah, right? And remember, without ATP, how long will our brain stay conscious?
2 to 3 seconds.
Yeah, 2 to 3 seconds, right? So we need these mitochondria working for us all the time. But of course, they can only under aerobic conditions. Here's something that people are becoming really concerned with because we're realizing this. What happens to this really fancy setup right here under anaerobic conditions? Okay, it stops, but you know what? Check this out. This mitochondria really likes to have a proton gradient across this membrane. That's really what it's designed to do. Here's one way it can do it, through electron transport chain. But if the electron transport chain shuts down, there's another way mitochondria can maintain this proton gradient. And look at this. What can a mitochondria do? It can take ATP and run this pump backwards. So under anaerobic conditions, or when tissue becomes ischemic, like during a stroke or something, the mitochondria do what to ATP? They use it up, and that puts that tissue further in jeopardy, right? So it would be really nice for us to be able to manipulate this respiratory assembly when somebody is under ischemic conditions, and nobody in medicine really knows how to do that yet. Okay, so mitochondria are great as long as we keep them happy, okay, in a sense of thinking about that. Okay, so we talked about that function. All right, so we got to do a little bookkeeping of ATP formation. And for this class, we're not going to be too sophisticated. So let's get one of these ways taken care of right away, which you already have. Under anaerobic conditions, how many ATP can be produced from one glucose molecule?
Two.
And that is through glycolysis, right? And what kind of phosphorylation step is that? Substrate level phosphorylation, right? And glycolysis will remain open as long as pyruvic acid can be converted into lactate and shipped out of the cell. In so doing, it regenerates NAD+, so that glycolysis can stay operating. So anaerobic respiration produces 2 ATP. Now what about under aerobic conditions? Well, we got to consider some direct or substrate level phosphorylation and oxidative phosphorylation. Okay? And if we tally up all the ATPs that can be produced under aerobic conditions, it's going to be 30 something, depending on conditions inside the cell. Right? And I told you, I don't care if it's 2.5 or 2.75 ATP for every NADH, right? We're just going to say 3. All right, so under aerobic conditions, right, for every glucose, we can make between 30 and 36 ATP, maybe 38 under the exact right conditions. All right, so yeah, so what are the ballpark numbers I want you to know when you compare anaerobic and aerobic? 2 versus 30-something. Yeah, 30-something. Should be like a TV show or something like that. Okay? So I'm not going to ask you for aerobic respiration, how many ATP produced? 31, 32, 33, 34. It's going to be what? 30-something versus 2. Right? So that's really what I want you to be aware of and concerned with. Right? So another way of thinking of that is if you're going to go fill up your car with gasoline and you have a choice of 2 gas stations, and they're both going to charge you $5 a gallon for gas, exactly the same amount of money. You can go to one gas station and you can drive 32 miles per gallon on one when you fill up at that gas station. But if you go to the other one, you can only drive 2 miles for the same cost, right, because it's still only a gallon. Which gas station are you going to go to? Yeah, you're going to go to the one where you get much better gas mileage, right? So think of that as a way to understand how important that ATP production is. All right, so here's a pretty good slide. All right, 3 ATP for each pair of NADH. Now this is inside the mitochondria, 2 from every FADH2. Okay, and so there's 26 via the electron transport chain, 2 from glycolysis, 2 from direct phosphorylation or substrate level phosphorylation in Krebs cycle. And that's about 30-something for every glucose molecule. Right, so this slide is pretty good right here. Right, so it just says glucose to pyruvate. We know that to be glycolysis. How many ATP are produced? 2. Yeah, that's really nice. Okay, but it also produces some NADH. And that NADH is in the cytosol, not mitochondria. It takes some energy to get that NADH into the mitochondria, so some energy is lost with that. Okay, and so I think you can just run down these various tallies through here. So glycolysis, 2 ATP, right? Pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA. I think it's important to know something there. What's happening there? It's an oxidation reduction reaction. It's a decarboxylation as well. So it produces NADH, right? That's inside the mitochondria. How many ATPs can be produced from every NADH inside the mitochondria? 3, right? So that preparatory reaction all by itself indirectly produces a lot of ATP. So in this calculation here, right, I wouldn't put 2.5, I would put 3. Right, for this right here, 2. I would simplify that. All right, so it's going to be what, 30-something for oxidative for aerobic respiration, okay, utilizing mitochondria. Okay, you might have some questions about that. See me during office hours. You know, we can work through that, but it's not too difficult.
So
every for every glucose molecule that is metabolized? All right, so for every glucose molecule, how many CO2 are produced? How many CO2s are produced? Okay. How many carbon atoms are there in glucose? Every single carbon atom in glucose eventually is going to be converted into CO2. Right? Because for every pyruvate, which is half of a glucose, yeah, preparatory reaction makes one, Krebs cycle makes two. That's three. And how many times does Krebs cycle go around for every glucose? Yeah, so that's six. Yeah, so every carbon in glucose eventually gets turned into CO2, which is pretty cool because what did that plant do? I don't have a picture handy. What did the plant do? It took CO2, right, and energy to make glucose out of it. We're just doing the reverse thing of what that plant did. Okay, so that's pretty nice the way that works. Really good. All right, so that plant needs CO2, right, in order to do its job. And we need glucose, so it's a pretty nice relationship. All right, and I know a lot of people are freaking out about CO2 concentration in the planet because it's a greenhouse gas, but CO2 is a rate-limiting chemical for photosynthesis. It's like the basis of all life on the planet. So I'm not quite so concerned with CO2 buildup in the air because when CO2 builds up, photosynthesis increases, which then does what to CO2? Yeah, well, it decreases CO2, makes more oxygen. So that I'm not so concerned with, but there are other chemicals that can be much more dangerous in terms of greenhouse gases. That's what I would really focus on.
Plant more trees.
Plant more trees. Yeah, actually, there's a plant that really does a marvelous stuff, and that's lawns, grass. Converts a lot, but there's a cost to that because what does a lawn need?
Water.
Yeah, there's no easy answer to some of this stuff. Okay. Okay. All right. Fats and proteins. So we looked at glycolysis, Krebs, electron transport so far. What class of biological molecules did we look at to fuel all of those reactions? Carbohydrates, that's right, but there's two others, right? There's fats and proteins can be used as energy sources. Let me see what I can say about some of this stuff, all right? So a triglyceride can be broken down into, of course, glycerol and how many fatty acids? Three, that's right. And these fatty acids can be modified and run through the Krebs cycle to produce all those compounds like the ATP through substrate level phosphorylation, the three NADHs and an FADH2. All right, proteins can be broken down the same way and parts of them can be donated to the Krebs cycle, right? But they have to be deaminated first because it's an amino acid, right? It has to be deaminated. The amino group is pretty toxic. So fortunately, our kidneys can get rid of it for us. All right, so some of these pathways can be used to interconvert carbohydrates, fats, and proteins, and most of these things can be used as an energy source because they can enter into the Krebs cycle. All right, so let's just talk about fats first. There's something missing from the slide, which I would like for you to see. Okay, so here's a fat. I would like for you, and here's the what this fat can be broken down into, glycerol and fatty acids. So what kind of fat is that? Yeah, it's a triglyceride. You see that right away. So fat, put triglyceride. And so what we're talking about on this diagram pretty much is just a triglyceride. All right, so what kind of enzyme is used to take a triglyceride and convert it into glycerol and three fatty acids? And I mentioned this a couple times ago, and you haven't worked with it, so there's probably no way you can remember, but maybe you can. That is a lipase, right? A lipase causes the hydrolysis of a triglyceride into its building blocks, right? Which you know is glycerol, three fatty acids. Okay, now, how many arrows do you see at this step right here? I see two, right? It can go forwards or backwards, depending on the needs of the cell. Indeed, that's possible. All right, if you have this glycerol, it's how many carbons are in glycerol?
Three.
There are three. Do you know of any three-carbon intermediates in any of the metabolic pathways that we looked at so far? Yeah, pyruvic acid, a whole bunch in glycolysis, right? So glycerol, with some modification, can enter into glycolysis because it has three carbons. It has that odd number of carbons. right? And then what can happen to it then? Converted into pyruvic acid, and the preparatory reaction goes into the Krebs cycle, produces a lot of ATP, right? That's just glycerol. Fatty acids, on the other hand, remember, are these small molecules or large molecules? How would you think of a fatty acid? I would say big, because it's a big, long chain of hydrocarbons, right? It might have 18 carbons, maybe 22 carbons, something like that is really long. All right, so these fatty acids then can be broken down into acetyl-CoA. How many carbons are in this acetyl group? Yeah, there's actually two. Right, remember, going from pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA, there's a decarboxylation step that happens, there's an oxidation reduction reaction happening here. So these fatty acids will produce many acetyl-CoA. You know that there's two carbons in there. So that kind of tells you that a fatty acid is broken down in steps of how many carbons? Two carbons at a time, which is an acetyl group, right? So, and this process of taking fatty acids and making acetyl-CoA, and indeed some energy, this is going to generate some energy. This is what we call beta oxidation. That's really good for you to put down on this slide, I think. Beta oxidation. So here is at beta oxidation. Do you see the difference between beta oxidation and lipolysis? Right here. Indeed, that's it. Converting fatty acids into acetyl-CoA, beta oxidation. Okay. So do you see, could you describe to me the difference between where beta oxidation takes place and lipolysis? Lipase works by converting fats to glycerol and fatty acids. Beta oxidation works by changing fatty acids to acetyl-CoA. Two different things. I think your book does a pretty good job of that, but sometimes maybe not so much. And of course, with that acetyl-CoA, then it can be run through the Krebs cycle, right? And so, for instance, if this is a 20-carbon fatty acid, how many acetyl-CoAs can be generated? 10. So this Krebs cycle can operate glucose twice, but for that fatty acid, 10 times, 5 times as much energy is produced by that fatty acid. And how many are there on this triglyceride? Yeah, there's 3. So it's really a magnificent form of energy storage because of that. All right, so beta oxidation versus lipolysis. What else do we want to see on this slide right here? Can I show you something about this one right here? Okay, maybe I can. All right, so here we have a bunch of carbon molecules that have either 6 or 3 carbon atoms, right? That's the only possibility for these glycolytic intermediates or these intermediates in glycolysis, right? After the preparatory reaction, then you have this acetyl group. Can acetyl-CoA go back to pyruvic acid?
No.
What do you see about this arrow right here? It's one-way arrow, right? Okay, so anytime you have a 2-carbon fragment, it can't be combined in a way to make a 3-carbon molecule or a 6-carbon molecule. So once something is acetyl-CoA, it can never be converted into a carbohydrate.
So it can't, right? Be converted into a triglyceride.
But it can, yeah, because here is a 2-way street. So this acetyl group, right, can be converted into a fatty acid and then a triglyceride. Okay. But never into a sugar, right? Acetyl-A can never be converted into a sugar because we don't have the enzyme that allows for that to happen. Some animals do, but we don't. All right, so anytime, what is this fate of a fatty acid? I see 2 fates for a fatty acid. It can be used to make a triglyceride, or it can be used to make energy. Yeah, energy, ATP. Only 2 possible fates. All right, now, there is an adult beverage that we like to consume. Okay, beer, yeah. And what is the active ingredient that is very toxic to our nervous systems? It's alcohol, right? Does anybody know what kind of alcohol that is? Yeah? Ethanol. How many carbons are in ethanol? There are 2, right? And each one of these lines represents a hydrogen atom. I'm not going to draw it out. A couple of hydrogens, and then here is that hydroxyl group. So that's ethyl alcohol. All right, put that ethyl alcohol into this scheme right here. How does your body handle it? Can you make a sugar out of that?
No.
Because it only has two carbons, right? So ethyl alcohol only has two fates. And the two fates are make a triglyceride out of it, or fatty acid, right, which then could be converted into a triglyceride, or it can be used for energy. All right. So when you drink alcohol like this, it's like eating a bar of butter. Right, because that's all your body can do with it. It can only convert it into a fat. Or if you exercise strenuously when you're intoxicated, then maybe you can burn it up as an energy source. Well, beer is maybe even worse than that because it has a lot of carbohydrates too. So not only ethanol, but a lot of carbohydrates. Okay. So here's that acetyl-CoA. I think this slide is mostly right. Acetyl-CoA can make fatty acids, can be used to make cholesterol, right? It can enter the citric acid cycle. And citric acid cycle, if we look at these intermediates here, they're based on sugar molecules. So when we restrict our diet of sugar, or if we're a diabetic, for instance, because sugar can't enter cells, acetyl-CoA can't enter the citric acid cycle and make all those ATPs that we're familiar with now. What is the possible fate then? Well, when somebody's a diabetic or restricting carbohydrates severely, this acetyl-CoA is converted into ketone bodies, which we talked about maybe just a little bit before, right? And these are all based on two carbons. So ketone bodies are two carbons, four carbons kind of molecules, right, that are highly volatile that you can just breathe out of your body. So this is kind of a fascinating step right here that Dr. Atkins saw. Right, because he saw that you can take fatty acids, convert them into acetyl-CoA. This acetyl-CoA can't get into the citric acid cycle when we're low on sugars. So where does it go? It goes into ketone bodies, and then where do these ketone bodies go? You just exhale those lipids right out of your body. That's fascinating. But what's the cost for that if you're not careful? What is the Krebs cycle good for? Making a lot of ATP. Do you want ATP? Yeah, you definitely do, right? So you got to be really careful on those kind of diets because your brain will get really depressed. You will be dingy, right? Okay. So the opposite of lipolysis is lipogenesis. And you know the building blocks for lipogenesis. It's three fatty acids and a glycerol. Mostly occurs in adipose and liver tissues. And so this adipose is just an energy form. It's a storage form of energy in the body. Here's the other number. All right, so if we just measure out a gram of lipid, like triglycerides, and figure out what the energy, the caloric value is, it's 9 kilocalories per gram. All right, if we weigh the same amount of carbohydrate out and the same amount of protein, 1 gram, how many calories? There's only 4. So what's the difference between a gram of fat and a gram of sugar or protein? Yeah, definitely more than a factor of 2. Right? So that's why storing lipids in the body is a very efficient way of storing energy. But there's another thing too. What about all those triglycerides? Are they soluble in water or not? They're not, right? So when you store a triglyceride, you don't have to dissolve it in anything. It's just pure energy in the form of a lipid. Right, when you store glycogen, you have to store it in water. So when you store energy in the form of glucose or proteins, you also have to have additional weight in the form of water to store that energy. All right, so that just makes fat even more efficient because you can store it all by itself. It doesn't have to be packaged with anything else that is going to take up room. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
When you
back to use it, yeah.
To break it down,
yeah.
What would go from there? So you're storing
it. Okay. Yeah, you got this fat right here. Okay. And say you're in a fasted state, you're exercising, you don't have a lot of glucose. Okay. So then this triglyceride is going to be broken down by lipolysis. And then these fatty acids are going to be broken down by beta oxidation. It's going to produce, you know, 2 carbons at a time. I think I have a slide coming up maybe that shows a little bit about beta oxidation.
Oh, no, that makes
sense. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then that acetyl group enters the Krebs cycle, and, yeah, it just makes a lot of ATP. All right, so where does beta oxidation take place? Okay, and I would say mitochondria. Beta oxidation under aerobic or anaerobic conditions? Aerobic, and that's how it got its name, right? Beta oxidation. Okay. All right, so here is, oh, I just mentioned this. Here is a schema of beta oxidation. Here is a big, long fatty acid. And maybe I'll just say a couple of things about this. Here's that big, long fatty acid. All the carbon atoms aren't shown. Some activation energy is required from ATP. And at this step right here, we see coenzyme A attached to the fatty acid. Then if we do another oxidation reduction reaction, an FADH2 is produced. Right? And then finally, that acetyl-CoA is broken off, and you're left with a fatty acid that is two carbons less. Right? So fatty acid is just chopped two carbons at a time. And I think you can follow the scheme of this thing. No ATP is directly produced by beta oxidation, but what is produced? Carriers of high energy electrons, right? For FADH2, right? And an NADH here, right? And then this is inside the mitochondria. So for every FADH2, how many ATP for this class are we going to say are made?
Two.
And for every NADH inside the mitochondria, we're going to say three. Right, and this number you might have to adjust this one up as well. Okay. All right, so that's lipolysis and beta oxidation. We didn't talk much about proteins in here. Oh well, that's the way it goes. All right, so study this over the weekend and come back with a lot of questions next week. Because I'm not sure you could come up with any good questions right now.